thanks for coming along tonight, folks, in the aftermath of the 2022 election. So we've got two speakers here tonight who are familiar to all of you, and they've also been appeared at the Sydney Institute quite a few times in the past. So we've got Troy Bramson, senior writer at The Australian and author of his most recent book, Bob Hawke, Demons and Destiny, and Parnell McGuinness, managing director, strategy and policy at AC Agenda, columnist for the Sydney Morning Herald and a regular, well, a Friday night appearer on Sky News. The program's called
The Blame Game.
The Blame Game, yeah. So we're going to lead off with Troy, then we're going to go to Parnell, then we'll go to questions and discussion. And Troy, many thanks, and off we go.
Well, thanks very much, Jared, and thank you to Anne. It's good to be back at the Sydney Institute. I want to pay tribute to the role that the Institute plays in fostering good discussion and debate about political and policy and historical and cultural issues. Let me acknowledge Parnell as well. I'm going to make some observations about the election campaign, talk a little bit about Labor and the coalition, and then where to, and other parties, and then where to next. So let me start by saying that at the outset of the election campaign, I sat down face to face with Anthony Albanese for an interview for The Australian. He was very calm, very collected, and confident. In fact, he was so confident that he drank a can of Albo Pale Ale beer right in front of me with a younger looking Albanese on the can. So I looked at young Albo and old Albo at the same time during the interview. I don't think there's actually been a political leader who has transformed their beliefs more than Anthony Albanese. He was once a hard left political warrior in the Cold War, but today he's a centrist who preaches consensus and wants to bring Australians together. I sensed in that interview that he knew that victory was in sight. He had to change, and so he did shed his hard left image. He also had a personal makeover to show that he was match fit and ready for the job. He promised not a revolution, only to make things better. He was a small target, and he was derided as a weak leader, but he made the campaign somehow about leadership and about character, more importantly. He's not inspirational. He's not an intellectual, but he is a strategist. And I think his victory was in many ways a masterclass in political strategy. I do think we've just seen a political earthquake at the 2022 election, and I think the ramifications are still being fully understood, and it'll take some time until we do. There has long been a de-alignment take place in Australian politics. That's voters leaving the two major parties, and I say the National Party and the Liberal Party as one party, being the coalition, and Labor. But I do think it has accelerated at this election. So Labor looks like it has won government with just 32.6% of the vote. The coalition got 35.7%, and 33% went to minor parties or independents. Labor won a net 8 seats, just enough to win government, but its primary vote is absolutely dismal. It has never won government with a primary vote so low before. There's some warning signs for Labor in that it lost the seat of Fowler to an independent, and it also lost the seat of Griffith to the Greens. We have 6 seats won by so-called teal independents, 1 seat won by Dai Lee and Fowler, who doesn't identify as a teal. 3 seats were won by the Greens: Melbourne, Griffith, which was Labor, and Ryan, which was Liberal. The Australian Electoral Survey at the ANU does show this long-term de-alignment of the major parties, with the relationship between education and ideology reversing, so that both parties now win votes across the traditional left-right axis. But the big message, I think, in the election is that tribal loyalties are breaking down, and we are seeing a fragmentation of the two-party system, which I think has served us well in the post-war era. So to Labor, it is a narrow win with a record primary vote. It's not like 1972, 1983 or 2007. Labor looks to have a 2-seat majority after allocating a speaker. Labor did suffer some swings in its traditional heartland seats. It did lose, as I say, Griffith and Fowler. I think the low primary vote reflects reservations that I had and many others did about Anthony Albanese, about his appeal as a political leader, and also about Labor's small target strategy. I don't think Labor did enough to encourage people to vote Labor. So Labor actually wins government having achieved lower votes than it did at the last election. It's been a rapid start, first with a quintet of ministers sworn in just 2 days after the election, the fastest political transition in Australian history. There's now a 30-person ministry in place, 16 from the right faction, 14 from the left faction. The New South Wales Right Group is the largest faction in the Labor caucus with 19 members. It is the most experienced ever Labor ministry. Albanese is a 26-year parliamentary veteran. He has served in Parliament longer than any new Prime Minister since John McEwen. He has more experience in government than Rudd, Hawke or Whitlam. Now, Labor people say to me again and again during the campaign and after that they have learned the lessons from the Rudd-Gillard period, which was chaotic, shambolic, often dysfunctional. We will see, I think, a very different governing culture this time around. In terms of the caucus, the cabinet, the party union machine and the public service in terms of how they're treated. There will be no gang of four like there was during the Rudd government, which made decisions to the exclusion of the full cabinet. There is an emphasis on robust cabinet debate. When I interviewed Richard Marles, the new Deputy Prime Minister, week before last, after being sworn in, he said to me that going back to the Hawke approach for robust cabinet debate was really important. Rudd, in many ways, is the anti-model for this Labor government, and Hawke is the model. I think Anthony Albanese does understand this, and this is something that he emphasised to me. I also think there's no such thing as a green left in Australian politics. If you watch Sky News, some of the commentators who are my friends, and I go on their programs from time to time, talk about a green left in Australian politics. In fact, Labor hates the Greens, and the Greens hate Labor. And Anthony Albanese has been fighting the Greens for decades. And in fact, Labor is more likely to agree with the coalition parties on legislation than they are with the Greens. The ALP and the Greens are competitors. We can see that in Melbourne and Griffith, seats won by the Greens. And there are close contests around the country between ALP and Green candidates in places like Cooper, Grainler, McNamara, Richmond, Sydney, Wills, in Canberra. So let's talk about the Liberal Party. Peter Dutton is the 15th Liberal leader, the first from Queensland. He does break the leadership stranglehold from Sydney and Melbourne. The past five Liberal leaders have been from Sydney. It's a tough challenge, and I noted today in The Australian that being the first opposition leader after an election defeat usually means that he'll never be Prime Minister. The last person to do that was Andrew Fisher in 1914, and he was previously a Prime Minister. Dutton, though, is a tough operator. I don't think he should be underestimated. I think he's politically clever, but he has an image problem, and he has, to his credit, identified his image, which goes beyond superficially like how he looks, but more about his style and his approach in politics. I do think this election represents an existential challenge for the Liberal Party that goes to its identity, its values, its constituency, its members, its candidates, and its campaigning. I think some of the commentary from people in the Liberal Party, former Prime Ministers, members of Parliament, that suggest the Liberal Party should just give up on teal seats, such as North Sydney, Wentworth, McKellar, Kooyong, Goldstein, and Curtin, and then try to regain government by winning seats from Labor is bonkers. It's beyond crazy. There is no pathway for the Liberal Party by ceding those seats and focusing on Labor seats in Western Sydney and Western Melbourne to come into government at the next election or probably the one after or the one after that. The Liberal vote in those Western suburb seats is in the teens or in the 20s. They're a long way away from winning those seats. But more importantly, what does it mean about the Liberal Party's 30 to 40,000 members who still live in these, predominantly in these teal seats, and their donors that are clustered in these seats as well? The party can't just abandon them and start to look elsewhere. It needs to support, encourage, and maintain those members and those donors. I've argued repeatedly that the Liberal Party was founded as a party representing the middle and upper class, well-educated, affluent, professional, community-minded people, which sound very much like teal voters. And I don't think the Liberal Party should abandon those, because to appeal to less educated, lower income, working class Australians means a very, very different party to what Robert Menzies created with the help of others in 1944. Menzies wanted a Liberal, not a Conservative party, on the centre right, of course, but a broad church, forward looking, he said progressive and not reactionary. So I think the answer for the Liberal Party for its revival is to look to this Menzies model, not to move left, but to move back to the centre where elections are run and won in Australia. Make some comments about others in the parliament. We're going to see a very different parliament with three Greens MPs, a lot of independents, a very large crossbench. I think it's going to be hard for these teal seats to be won back by the Liberal Party. Labor MPs tell me they'll do everything they can to support them and entrench them to hold those seats at the next election. Albanese, being a former leader of the House in the Gillard Minority Parliament, is very attuned to this. So that makes it very difficult for the Liberal Party to return to power. It's 18 seats behind a majority at the moment, 18 seats. Labor might only have a majority of two after a speaker, but 18 is a long way back. Let's look at the Greens. They've been very, very successful. I was a little bit surprised, frankly, about the success of the Greens. I knew they were on the radar. I knew they were in with a shot in a number of seats, but I was sceptical. They did seem to have stalled for a number of years, but they're on the march. And I think they do threaten not only Labor seats, but Liberal seats. We saw the seat of Ryan, for example, fall to the Greens from Liberals, and also the seat of Brisbane fall from Liberal to Green. The Greens have a lot of seats in the Senate. They're in the crossbench there. They'll have a majority of members on the crossbench, and the Labor will have to negotiate with the Greens if the opposition is opposed to Labor policies. In conclusion, let me make a couple of other minor, a few other points. I think David Littleproud is a very good leader of the National Party. National Party has its own challenges. They held their seats, but they still suffered some swings in them. I think Barnaby Joyce was bad for the National Party, not only bad from the Liberal perspective, which Liberals ministers said he was terrible for their brand in the suburbs and cities, but he was gaffe-prone, scandal-prone. I think he was an embarrassment to the National Party. And it's a great tradition of leaders like Doug Anthony and Tim Fisher and John McEwen. I think Littleproud will be much more effective, and we should be encouraged that he said that his party will look to the sensible centre and will not be moving further to the right. So finally, just, you know, some brief comments about looking forward. The government has a triple whammy at the moment they've got to deal with: inflation, interest rates, and an energy shock. They've got huge budget deficits and record debt. It's going to be very, very challenging. Labor has a big agenda, which includes things they want to do this term, like a voice to parliament, an integrity commission, a national reconstruction fund, Jobs and Skills Australia, their energy plan, which they call Powering Australia, near universal childcare, and reform to aged care. Now, it's a big agenda, it's a lot, but it's not particularly too controversial. And there will be a lot of public support for many of those ideas and many of those policies, although I do think the voice will be particularly challenging. And finally, let me just conclude by saying the biggest test for the new government will probably be something that we cannot foresee, as it was for the last government. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. So, Parnell McGuinness.
Thank you.
That's really interesting. Thank you. And thanks to Jared and Anne for having me again. I really enjoy this, and I really enjoy watching the speeches when I'm not up here. I wanted to focus today a little bit on something which I think is interesting about this government and could turn out to be one of its greatest strengths and one of its greatest weaknesses. And that is virtue signalling and symbolism and how they use them. So just to start off, I'd say that, you know, from a governing perspective, the first fortnight of the Albanese Labor government seems to have gone very well indeed. Albanese's launched into the prime ministership as though he's got a clear idea of what he wants to do and how he's going to do it. And he's had plenty of time to observe mistakes made within his own party and contemplate failures across the aisle while in opposition. He's come to the conclusion, he says, that he'll need to unite Australia and change the way politics is done by avoiding sound bites and actually answering questions, which is novel and promising. He also made the right move by having himself sworn in early in order to head to the scheduled Quad meeting. That wasn't symbolism. It was an early and important affirmation of his commitment to the alliances that Australia relies on to secure its place in the world. His Foreign Minister Penny Wong popped over to the Solomon Islands to intercept China's attempt to build a Pacific power base. And the disappointment that of the Chinese in the region suggests that she's been effective, or at least that there are grounds to hope that she will be listened to. And in a situation that looked like it was rapidly getting away from Australia, even those small steps are important ones. Meanwhile, Treasurer Jim Chalmers, who is an unfolding talent, is rolling out his plan to steal the coalition from the coalition the mantle of better economic managers. All in all, from what we've seen so far, participating in two terms of regicidal government followed by 9 years in political exile looks like a pretty good forge in which to prepare a party of government. And Albanese's government is identifying clear problems and seeking solutions. If you were content to provide this type of competent government, even allowing for the fact that many on the right will disagree with some of his proposed solutions to growing problems such as energy security, he'd stand a good chance of establishing an uncontroversial, maybe even Angela Merkel-style government, which could hold power for years and years to come. But Labor governments seem rarely able to resist grand gestures. And good government is not the be-all and end-all of Prime Minister Albanese's ambitions. The fact is that as well as making many solid decisions in a remarkably short space of time, the PM has also hit the ground signalling. And one of the greatest puffs of smoke the new Prime Minister sent up regards a promised referendum to enshrine an Indigenous voice to Parliament in the Constitution. Now, I'm not against Indigenous constitutional recognition or even a voice proposal, but it is a solution which doesn't directly address any problem currently confronting Indigenous Australians. And until it's clearly articulated how the many and desperate problems confronting Indigenous Australians would be addressed by a voice to Parliament enshrined in the Constitution, it remains a luxury, otherwise known as a virtue signal. Naturally, Albanese's signal has been greeted rapturously by activists and advocates, and it'll continue to be greeted rapturously, no doubt, until the romance of the idea of a voice congeals into the pragmatism of a referendum question. At that point, unless the connection between the promise and the problem has been made clear, the success of the referendum will rely on the number of Australians willing to sign up to virtue and vapour. At the same time as the Indigenous voice has become a symbol of the new government's aspirations, the cashless welfare debit card has become a symbol of the diabolical realities. Many users of the card found it stigmatising and difficult to manage, and the evidence around the effectiveness of the card in reducing drug and alcohol in trial communities has been inconclusive. And so welfare groups and advocates object to it on principle and have campaigned for it to be discontinued. Inconveniently for the symbolists, though, their campaigns to get rid of the card have been in direct conflict with what some Indigenous communities, especially the women in them, want. Luckily, the Indigenous voice to Parliament has not yet been enshrined in the Constitution, because otherwise the government would have had to listen to Indigenous people before abolishing the cashless welfare card. So thank goodness for symbolism, eh? Activists and advocates in the Indigenous and welfare spaces can have fuzzy feelings without encountering the yucky contradictions of reality. Another piece of symbolism and signalling is the Prime Minister is also committed to taking up residence in the Lodge in Canberra. That symbolically situates him as the king of the public servants. And I suppose you could also say, by moving back to the capital, he's signalling that he's the Prime Minister for Australians of all states. Unfortunately, around the same time as he made his move to the Lodge, a group of Indigenous traditional owners used the 30th anniversary of the Mabo decision to announce their plan to lodge a native title claim over the ACT. So they lodged a claim on the Lodge while the PM took up lodgings at the Lodge. And there are so many fuzzy feelings in all of that that the line between who's doing right and who's doing wrong is getting very, very fuzzy indeed. And because you can never have too many symbols, Albanese also named an island in Canberra after the Queen of England, mm-hmm. while practically in the same breath swearing in an assistant minister for a republic. Mm-hmm. Introducing some unintentional symbolism on top of that, the island is a fake island located in the fake lake in the centre of the fake city, which the PM has symbolically committed to inhabiting, at least until his symbolic commitment to listen to Indigenous people has been converted into actual action. And so it's not very charitable of me, of course, to make fun of this jumble of clashing signals. But since we're speaking of charity and symbolic contradictions, I should also mention that the Albanese government's response to receiving the resignation of Charities Commissioner Gary Johns was decidedly uncharitable. Dr. Andrew Leigh, the economist responsible for charities, calls Johns' resignation the end of the Liberals' 9-year war on charities. And a new commissioner will be transparently appointed to allow charities to once again undertake political advocacy that is coincidentally charitable towards the Labor government, which just goes to show that sometimes an act can combine both symbolism and a solution to a well-defined enough problem. The key to Albanese's success, though, will be finding more such happy coincidences. If he wants to run a symbolism-heavy government that doesn't dissipate into a puff of contradictions. To be fair, there are signs that there are such initiatives underway, and it would be a mistake to dismiss all the warm, fuzzy terminology in this government as just woke smoke. Take, for instance, Treasurer Jim Chalmers. As I mentioned earlier, Dr. Chalmers is quite a talent and one to watch very carefully. He is on a mission to take the mantle of better economic managers for Labor. And yet he has foreshadowed a well-being budget, which sounds like debt-laden theoretical crap. So how does that marry up? Well, I'll tell you how. The well-being budget is a carefully concocted snow job. To conservatives, it sounds like nothing to be worried about, something that can be easily dismissed. And to Labor ears, it sounds like nothing to be worried about, something that can be easily embraced. What actually hides within it is the intention to measure the bang for buck of tax dollars better. Chalmers calls it measuring what matters, and has identified health and education as two areas which will be measured by the well-being budget. These are two areas in which increased spending has historically not necessarily translated into better public health and education outcomes. The Liberal Party, which has been saying this for years, of course, but nobody on that side of politics had the wit to adorn a program of spending reform with a well-being ribbon. It remains to be seen whether the Teachers' Federation will recognise that the new government is re-gifting them the same proposals for improving teacher quality, which report after report has found does not require yet more spending, but instead some genuine work on teachers and their training and their intake, with a love heart on top. Maybe as long as they're being told that they're being measured because they matter and a part of a Labor government well-being strategy, they might just lap it up. If so, I say more power to the Treasurer for harnessing the left-wing penchant for symbolism and feels to get through the desperately needed and overdue reforms while shielding the budget bottom line against new harebrained schemes. But all of this, I think, points to one conclusion. The ability to use symbolism to sell solutions to real problems will mark out successful ministers in this government from ones who struggled to deliver. And the ability to define a problem to match each virtue signal that the government wants to put up will define whether the government is able to succeed in its mission. It's as yet unclear to me whether Albanese will himself be able to tell a sales strategy from a virtual signal, let alone deploy symbolism for something more than its own sake. If he is, we may be in for a very long Labor reign. But if he isn't, this government will also go up in a puff of extremely virtuous smoke.
Thanks to Troy Bamson and Pernell McGuinness. And so we come to questions and discussion, and people on Zoom are welcome to send their questions or comments in the way indicated in the email that went out today. And so we both come back here and stand on either side, and I'll go over here. I'll just lead off, I thought, with both of you commenting, because Troy made some important points about the Teals and how the Liberals need to win at least some of those six seats that they lost to the Teals. And yesterday, Tony Burke, the leader of the government in the House, was talking on radio, and he said, that, like you said, that the government would be very good to the Teals, they would acknowledge them. And then he went on to say what you would expect him to say, that they will get a big share of the question time and no doubt a big share of the speaking time, but that doesn't deliver anything. So what do you think the Teals, who some of whom have gone in with big promises, 60% reduction in for half of them in emissions, tax reform from the new member for Wentworth, what do you think they can achieve, they can take back to their electorate, that Labor will let them achieve, apart from giving speeches and asking questions? So start with Troy, go to Parnell, then we go to everyone else.
Well, I think it's interesting that somebody like Zali Stegall in the seat of Warringah really didn't achieve much, if anything at all, for her constituency in the first term. But her vote went up, her primary vote went up, and so she's become more popular and more entrenched. And I think she's going to be very, very difficult to defeat. So there's actually an interesting element here in our politics, which is probably necessary to unpack, which is you actually have to deliver things, or do you have to actually just say things that people like and agree with? Style does matter in politics, and people liked her style, they liked her approach. But now the Teals that have joined her have a chance to actually achieve things for her electorate. So I think Tony Burke is foreshadowing how they will embrace them, hug them close, support them, encourage them, perhaps give them things they might ask for, some initiatives for a community or a sporting organisation, a grant here and there, which they'll then be able to announce, which will be in a budget, for example. And Labor's purpose here is to entrench those Teals, because if they can keep those Teals in place, then Labor can continue to govern with a very, very small majority or even a minority. I mean, Labor could feasibly lose half a dozen seats at the next election, but still be able to form a second government, whereas the coalition will be still miles away if the Teals are there. So I think that's a foreshadowing of what we're going to see to come.
Parnell?
Hi. I think that, I suspect that they'll be used as part of the sales strategy. So the thing about the Teals is that they look fantastic. One of the reasons for their vote is because they symbolised something to those electorates, which those electorates felt the need to introduce into Parliament, a certain style, a certain professional sort of person who is advocating for these important measures to them on their behalf. I think that Labor will, if it is clever, use them as a marketing tool while sort of pulling back some of these measures. But as Troy says, if they've been Duchessed well enough, then they will make the arguments back to their communities as to why these reforms that Labor is then putting on the table are sufficient and are what was being looked for by those communities all along.
But do you think giving them swimming pools or community centres would get through the new ICAC?
Well, that's a serious point.
They actually don't want swimming pools or women or centres because they've got them in their own backyards. where the changes are is they're going to have to be teased out what is state and what is federal, because a lot of the Teal asks are actually state asks.
Thank you. Just building on that last comment, someone who lives in Zali Stegall's electorate, almost all of her literature for 3 years has been piggybacking on the Liberal state government's new roads and community commitments, and that's what's, I think, increased her vote. It hasn't been federal issues at all. The one thing that I'd be interested in your comment on, the one thing that would be easy for the Albanese government to give to the Teals is a New South Wales-style ICAC in the federal parliament, because the chickens don't come home to roost necessarily as quickly as they did in New South Wales some years ago. But I have a more substantive question for you both, and that is, as the reality of the economy and the situation we're in, from both national security, energy cost, world trade and inflation and interest rates starts to hit, as it already seems to have registered with, as you say, with Chalmers and the government, won't we potentially find that Labor's embracing continuation of the coal power stations and doing all sorts of things that ought to put them at odds with the Teals and the Greens, and so they will have both of those attacking them unless they give out a lot of goodies to them?
Well, let's start off with Troy, then go to panel.
Yeah, look, I think the energy challenge is going to be a big one for the government. There's no doubt about that. One of the things that's been interesting to watch with Anthony Albanese is that he's very committed to delivering what he promised. So he's not going to, you know, before the election, he said he would not be doing deals with the Greens. He'd not be doing deals with the Teals. He would govern in his own right, or he would seek to govern in his own right. And there was a suggestion made that if he was in a minority, it would not be a style of Gillard government minority where there are formal agreements in place. So I suspect that they're not going to be dragged to the left. I think they're very conscious of that. And Chris Bowen, who I think will be an effective minister, he worked out a very detailed energy policy, which is about decarbonising the economy and a transition. It's not essentially a Green Party style policy. It's very much a transitional policy. So I don't think Labor is going to be moved beyond what they've promised to do. They have a majority that's going to help them. They are not particularly fazed by having to rely on the Greens in the Senate if the opposition doesn't support them, because they can use that to their advantage. And so I think we're going to see a government that is focused on delivering what they've promised. I'll make a brief point about the Integrity Commission. This is a debate we're yet to have. I mean, everyone thinks, sure, an Integrity Commission, most people think it's a reasonable idea. There are many different models, and I have some reservations about the New South Wales ICAC model. We're yet to see a detailed model from Labor, or one that might be able to get through the Parliament. That's going to be very challenging for them. And I want to table this. Integrity is different to corruption. So by calling it an Integrity Commission is actually widening the scope as to what someone might believe is behaviour that doesn't have integrity about it. And that could be a long way away from behaviour that is corrupt. So this is going to be a challenge for Labor about how they define how this commission will actually work and operate in practice.
Look, I think that the Integrity Commission is a really interesting one. I suspect that it will be less urgent to the Teals now that the Liberals are no longer in government. I think a lot of the calls for things before the election were actually specifically anti-Morrison and Morrison government calls. So, you know, there was this notion that there was corruption riddled throughout his front bench and that Morrison himself should be investigated on some fronts. I think that that it is going to seem a whole lot less urgent, and that Labor will probably go slow on it as a result. Also, because as Troy points out, these sort of things tend to be very thorny and you always get caught on them yourselves. And it's not like there are no Labor people with no skeletons in the cupboard. But that's a whole other story about the number of things that are going to come out on that eventually.
Question down here. It's on top of you.
Thank you, Jared. And Troy, I just wanted to pick up a point, and it's a bit of a follow-on from Jared's question, a point you made about, obviously I agree, people close to the Labor parliamentarians dislike the Greens and the Greens dislike Labor. But I think on the street, the average voter, that's probably not as strong a dichotomy as what you picked up. So if I cast your mind forward to maybe the next election or even the one after, if there's a situation, is it your opinion that Labor would not form a bit of a more formal coalition with the Greens, who are probably disaffected Labor voters in a way because their primary vote leaks, but rather form minority government with Teals, who are essentially disaffected Liberal voters?
I think it was interesting to see in the lead up to the election where we saw these scenarios being canvassed, that Labor said there wouldn't be a formal style a deal, an agreement. Some of you might remember in 2010, Julia Gillard sitting down side by side with Bob Brown, surrounded by, I think, nine other Greens MPs or senators, And they signed a formal document with Wayne Swan there as well. That was never going to happen again, and it won't happen again in the future. So I still maintain my view that Labor people, Labor MPs I'm talking about, hate the Greens more than they hate Liberals or Nationals. Like the intense rivalry is so hot, there's not going to be any style of Labor-Green government in the future. If Labor does fall into minority, what they would be looking for are agreements on supply and confidence, undertakings given, but not detailed negotiations about, you know, you have my support if you agree to this piece of legislation. And in fact, I wrote a story in The Australian a week or two ago about the negotiations that led up to the first five ministers being sworn in, and I wrote about the letters that were exchanged between Scott Morrison and the Governor-General and Anthony Albanese. And part of that was that Anthony Albanese had rung a bunch of the independents, including Bob Catter, to ask for guarantees of supply and confidence. And he had those, and he told those to the, he had that to the, to tell the Governor General, but he didn't ring Adam Beck. He didn't have a guarantee from Adam Beck. He wasn't seeking one. The other point I'll make is this. I interviewed Bob Brown a while ago, and he said to me, look, you know, the future for Labor and the Greens is a coalition together, like they'd work in Europe, but, you know, that's a Green idea. It's not a Labor idea. So I just don't think there'd ever be any scenario where we would see a formal coalition government with Labor and the Greens.
You want to comment on that, panel?
I'd just say that in Europe, in Germany in particular, but in the UK as well, the alliances that have been forming are actually Conservative Green, not Social Democrat Green. And I think that that will probably start being the case in Australia as well. If the Greens, you know, they have been sort of moving towards that style of trying to become more pragmatic. Also, it is notable how many people voted Green rather than Liberal in the last election. So it's always talked about how many people voted Teal instead of Liberal, but actually the protest vote went to the Greens in many electorates, and I suspect that will come back, but might come back a little bit green-tinged.
Thank you. I refer to Greg Sheridan's open letter concerning to Albanese concerning primarily the defence situation in the Australian. Do you have any comments on that, and with the current state of our economy, where do you see Labor going with the level of defence spending, and any ideas on their attitude towards improving our defence capabilities?
Both major parties are committed to increasing defence spending. That was clear commitments that were given by Josh Frydenberg at the last election and also Jim Chalmers. There is a recognition that we need to spend more of the budget on defence, and that's the position of both parties. I actually don't think there's really any significant difference between the major parties at all on defence policy, and some of the claims made about Richard Marles, for example, being a Manchurian candidate and so on, were just absolute garbage. I mean, Marles is regarded, the defence minister is regarded as a hawk, for those who know him. He's actually very close to the United States, has very deep links with previous United States and current administration there. So I can't see any major differences there at all. I mean, and Richard Marles is committed to the submarine, nuclear submarine program. And, you know, it just shows you the how different the Labor Party is. I mean, Anthony Albanese would have been marching around these streets about uranium mining, and now he's supporting nuclear-powered submarines. It is incredible. But defence, I think there's pretty much universal agreement.
Do you want to comment on that?
I don't really have anything.
To Troy and about the impression I get, so you may want to incorporate a personal explanation. The answer was that when Albanese became leader, it wasn't a good move by the Labor Party because he'd had pretty well extreme positions in the past, actually. He'd had form. He was a resident critic of Keating and Hawke's reforms, and the Liberals could just simply use his record against him, actually. So I'm just wondering how genuine you think his conversion is, how many of those convictions are now previous convictions, And secondly, with the Teals, with Burke saying they could get more parliament airtime, they may well end up being attacked on the left in relation to refugees, climate change, and they may regret the amount of airtime they give them.
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm always conscious about getting a bad write-up in Jared's end-of-year column about predictions. So I did say, when Anthony Albanese was elected leader, that he was unelectable unless he radically changed. And just a few weeks before the election, I got a bit nervous. I went back and read what I wrote, and I actually wrote that. I said that he'd have to undergo an incredible transformation to be a viable political leader. And he did. I mean, it is absolutely incredible. Not only the policies that Bill Shorten took to the previous election on, you know, negative gearing and franking credits and all these kind of things. He dumped all them. He did move the Labor Party to the centre by getting rid of a lot of these policies. He did jump the class war rhetoric, the language that was sort of anti-business. He did adopt a very aspirational language in his tone, bringing people together, the uniter, not a divider. So, you know, we can only judge him on what he said and what he took to the election. I've interviewed him a number of times during the election, and I found that he was committed to the things that he has now embraced and the different style. In fact, he went so far as to say that he doesn't believe in many of the things he once believed when he was 20 years old, and he has changed. I mean, I've read out several times to him a list of things that he had supported, you know, death taxes, inheritance taxes, he opposed uranium mining, all the Hawke government major policies, the float of the dollar, privatisation, tariff reductions. He opposed all those things, and he accepted to me, yeah, I've changed my view. So what do you say to that? Well, he's changed his view, and the Australian people, or enough of them, accepted that.
So just before we go on, just tell us a bit about your own relationship with him, because you were regarded as a great critic of him, and some people in the Labor Party thought you were too tough on him. But you've obviously sort of mended bridges, or he changed, you changed. I mean, talk about the personal relationship.
Yeah, we don't really have a personal relationship. I just thought that he was unelectable. I just know his background very, very well. I mean, I first saw him at a Labor Party conference in the early 1990s, thumping the podium at the Sydney Town Hall. I'm well aware of, you know, having just written this biography of Bob Hawke, how he opposed almost all of the major economic reforms of the Hawke government. I know that he was very close to and worked for Tom Uren and people like that. I mean, you know, he was a part of the hard left faction in New South Wales. He was as radical as you could get. He was a firebrand Labor figure. I mean, he was, you know, in the student Christian, he was in the student political movement, he was, you know, seen as someone who was really right out there. On the left, and he has changed and he has moderated. He's been in Parliament for 26 years and he changed his views, and he made a big deal about saying that he'll go and talk to anyone anywhere, and he's not afraid to be interviewed by anyone. And so I asked him last year, well, let's sit down and do an interview, and I presented all these things in his background, and he accepted it, and we had quite a good discussion. My last question to him was, why did you agree to do this interview? And he said, well, because he thought I made a good case about him. If he's serious, he needs to be put under scrutiny and answer some tough questions. He did think that some of the things I've written were pretty ordinary, and did call me a dickhead, I think, at one point. But that's okay. That's fine. You know, that's the rough and tumble of politics and journalism. And now I'd say I have a professional relationship with him as a journalist, like I do with political figures on both sides of the divide.
So we go to Dimitri, then I think you've got one on the
Zoom. Thanks for your presentation. Prime Minister Albanese has said he wants to govern in the model of Bob Hawke. One of the factors that allowed Bob Hawke to govern in the model of Bob Hawke was that the opposition was responsible and sensible. What is the likelihood that this opposition will support sensible economic reform, or is Peter Dutton going to stand up and say every mother loves their baby?
I think there's a lot of pressure on the coalition at the moment to be very differentiated and say no to everything. I think that Dutton will moderate that instinct shortly. I think that, you know, sort of this is that period, that really uncomfortable period following a change of government where the opposition is trying to figure out who it is and how it's going to behave. And it's actually making a lot of mistakes because it's launching into it too early. I suspect that Dutton will realise his mistake before too long and take a bit of a step back on that. I mean, you know, they obviously have to be an effective opposition, but this whole discussion about left-right, you know, Dutton has risen above that, realises that is incorrect. What he hasn't quite figured out yet is that he has to do the balance between pragmatic and aspirational. So he has to find the centre, not between the left and the right, but between what is the best way to do things and, you know, and the desired way of the Labour Party to do them. And that's where I think he will take things. Maybe it's just faith, the misplaced faith, but I think that that's where he's going to end up within the next few months.
So we go to Anne, then I've got a question from James Franklin.
Over the years, it seems we follow New Zealand after a little while, and it seems to me like we've kind of gone the way of the voters that voted in the Ardern government. But they haven't had the crisis that's coming financially, and there was a famous person who once says, it's the economy, stupid. And right now, Ardern's behind in the polls and not doing very well, and quite possibly will lose the next election. So I know it's the honeymoon period and I know we're a different country, but really, what do you think this economic crisis is going to do, and will it have a similar effect on the kind of left-dreaming aspirations of the Greens and the Teals?
Well, I would just say that, you know, there will be a honeymoon period, but it's not going to last forever. Labor will be able to blame the previous government for everything that's gone wrong, but there's a limit to how long you can do that. You can also blame international circumstances, but there's going to be a limit there as well. I think that in terms of Labor and managing the economy, it's going to be difficult. And if it continues to go pear-shaped, people facing higher costs at the supermarket, their mortgages are going up, higher energy costs, well, there's going to be a lot of pressure on the government to deliver, and it's going to be challenging. And all I can say, Anne, is that it's going to be difficult for them. But the one thing they'll have, speaking just politically, in their favour, is that the previous government, you know, taxed, spent, raked up debt to previous levels never seen before in this country. So I thought it was actually hilarious to see in the last couple of days coalition spokespeople saying we need to get the budget back to surplus and deal with the debt problem. Well, hello, where have you been for, you know, 6 years? Remember, Joe Hockey promised to deliver a budget surplus in his first year and every year after that, long before the pandemic, and never did it. So in many ways, when the Fraser government went out of office, they left a large budget deficit, and the Hawke and Keating made much of that, and then were able to fiscally repair the budget ahead of the 1990 recession. And deliver four surpluses. So we may see a similar thing happen here where Labor can kind of, in a sense, take the mantle of fiscal and economic responsibility and use that to their advantage.
I would just add on to that, if I may, just that this is what I mean about watch Jim Chalmers. The man is a serious talent. He is. He has a really clear plan for what he's doing as Treasurer, and he has, moreover, a political plan for how he is going to reframe Labor as the better economic managers. I think, you know, potentially the first is going to be good for the country. The second will be interesting to watch. But Albanese, as we saw throughout the campaign, almost played second fiddle to Chalmers a lot of the time. Chalmers is a lot of the intellectual weight behind this government, in my assessment.
So we're going to go down the back in a minute. I've got a question here about Wentworth, which I think is sort of not entirely serious, but the question is, do you think a woman who's articulate, a bit like you, could win Wentworth? So you're not running, are you, Parnell?
No, I'm not. Moreover, I don't live in Wentworth, so that's a problem. but no, look, I think not right now. I think there will be I suspect a lot of these voters, the teal voters, will come back to the Liberal Party, but the Liberal Party will have found itself anew first, and it's got a lot of challenges to overcome before that is going to be possible, you know. And that's what I was talking about, you know, sort of finding itself not between the left and the right, those typical things, but finding itself by proposing better solutions. I don't think at the moment it could be the most wonderful candidate in the world, and they would not go back to the Liberal Party right now in Wentworth for that candidate. But give it a couple of years of talking about what's wrong with universal childcare delivered through institutions with no flexibility, give it a couple of years of really critiquing the policies of the Labor Party, some of which are really sort of, you know, are very much union geared, and that's when people will start moving away from, you know, and Morrison's gone, there isn't so much to hate about the party anymore, that's when it's going to be in play again.
Question on the back.
Jimmy.
Tor, you said something which really jarred me when you made the suggestion that the result of this election is an existential threat to the coalition. I have two questions. What do you really think are the prospects of that happening, of the coalition in fact imploding? And if it does, what do you see as the future of government in Australia? I mean, it's a horrific scenario.
Well, I think it is, and I outline in my presentation all the reasons for that. The declining vote, the loss of these heartland seats, you know, blue ribbon heartland Liberal seats. And something I didn't mention in my speech is, let's look at the Liberal Party base in seats held by Liberal Prime Ministers. They're all gone. Almost all of them are gone. Menzies seat, Holt, Gordon, McMahon, Howard, Abbott, Turnbull, all the seats they held are gone. They're held by Labor or they're held by Independents. So I do think there is an existential crisis facing the Liberal Party. I don't think there's one facing the National Party. I think if the National Party merged with the Liberal Party, another rural voice would emerge and take that constituency. So that's why I've never really supported the idea of a merger. But I do think the Liberal Party does face an existential crisis, and we should remember that political parties don't last forever. I mean, the Australian Labor Party is one of the most successful political parties in the world, formed in 1891. As you all know, but the modern Liberal Party was only formed in 1944. We've had many other parties in Australia come and go, and that's the experience overseas. And look at what happened in France in the presidential elections there. The mainstream centre-right and centre-left parties are now a joke. They can hardly get 10% of the vote each. And Emmanuel Macron created a centrist party, which has been very, very successful. He's won two 5-year terms as president. And the party on the far right has increased its support, and the party on the far left has increased its support. So we shouldn't comfort ourselves by the fact that political parties will always remain. They come and go. I just don't think there's many signs yet that the Liberal Party fully understands this earthquake that has happened. I mean, it has shattered the party. The loss of these seats are totemic. They're important. I can't see them coming back. They need to work out what they stand for. And the idea, you know, Tony Abbott has said, oh, well, the cultural heartland of the party is no longer in, you know, the seat of Wentworth, it's now going to be in the seat of Lindsay. Well, that's great, but that's not the Liberal Party that Robert Menzies created. That's a fundamentally different place and a constituency, and that's not the Liberal Party that he created. So we may see a new style of Liberal Party form. But at the moment, they need to recognise it. And I'll make a point about Catherine Deves, the candidate for Warringah. She had a lot of support among some right-wing commentators. But at the end of the day, you only judge a candidate's success on the vote. And she took the Liberal Party vote backwards in the seat of Warringah. So I think she was a terrible candidate. I think she damaged the party's brand. They paid the price for it. That seat is now essentially entrenched with Zali Stigall, who I think will hold that seat as long as she wants it.
Anil,
I agree, she was a terrible candidate, and but I would take issue with the problem with Catherine Deves, I think, is always that it's not teased out. She was a terrible candidate. She was unable to communicate her point, and she was put in an invidious position by Morrison, who used the trans issue as a sort of a weapon, a tool. So instead of talking to women about something that is actually quite close to their hearts, i.e. the notion that just as trans people get respected for who they are, women should be respected for who they are and their physical realities, it ended up being this weird thing about trans kids, you know, primary school kids playing sport, prosecuted by a candidate with some shortcomings, in a government with very many shortcomings. I think that issue has a whole new round to play anyway.
I'm going to ask a final question, just move together to both of you. Both of you have looked about the issues on the left of the Labour Party, particularly the Greens. But what about on the right of the coalition? Because you look at the various groups, some of them have got a lot of publicity. The Liberal Democrats got, I think, around 2%, even Campbell Newman in Queensland, less than 3% in the Senate. John Ruddock here in New South Wales, about 2%. Pauline Hanson may win the 6th Senate seat in Queensland, but it's no sure thing. She probably will. Palmer's so-called United Australia Party, massive spending, very low vote. So what does that tell us about that side? Because that side of the coalition thought that they, in a sense, had the answer for a weak Liberal Party, and that looks like being a greater disaster, or as great disaster as the Liberal Party faced. So we'll just start off with Troy, end up with Parnell.
Yeah, look, there was a lot of hype and a lot of expectation about Pauline Hanson's One Nation, about the Clive Palmer United Australia Party, the Liberal Democrats. They all performed pretty poorly in this election. Pauline Hanson will probably be lucky to scrape back into the Senate herself. So all that publicity they got, particularly on Sky News after dark, didn't help them at all. And it's interesting to note that, you know, the Greens went from 1 to 3 seats in the lower house, where, of course, you form a government, and none of these other parties are breaking into the lower house at all. So, you know, the Greens, I think, are on the march, and it should send shockwaves, to take up the point that Parnell raised, it should send shockwaves to the Liberal Party that they won the seat of Ryan. That's a Liberal Party. Who would have ever thought and the seat of Brisbane, the Greens could win seats from the Liberal Party, let alone the Labor Party. So these other parties just have underperformed. And so maximum media coverage hasn't translated to votes. And people like John Ruddock and Campbell Newman, their performance in this campaign has been embarrassing, frankly, and others like Craig Kelly too.
Yeah, look, I agree. I think that what those little parties show is that you have to make a really strong case for what you stand for. You know, all of the successful Teal candidates had a really clear set of messages. So 3 positive messages, the climate message, the ICAC, and basically get rid of Morrison. You know, and those were the things around which people rallied to vote for them. I'm not convinced that the Greens have had as much a coup as people say they have. So definitely taking seats off the Labor Party was a big deal, but I cannot tell you how many traditionally Liberal voters have said, I voted Green to make my seat more marginal because I'm all. So, you know, I think that there was a lot of strategic voting in this election, and I think that it'll take us a little while before we tease out how much of it was strategic voting and what actually represents a big shift.
Well, many thanks to both our speakers. It's been quite a fascinating night, and a lot of wide-ranging discussion. So all I can really say right on time is thanks for a great evening. Well done. Well done.